Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, State Attorney General Maura Healey signs off on the Beth Israel Lahey merger with some major conditions.
This is significantly more than any other type of constraint that the state has ever imposed.
Also today, the sexual misconduct lawsuit against three Dartmouth College professors and what it suggests about the culture facing many women in science.
It was the scaffolding, the architecture that sort of upheld the pattern of abuse previously, and that scaffolding is still there.
Plus, we talk with a man who had been corresponding with mobster Whitey Bulger before Bulger was killed in prison last month.
He told me things he didn't tell his family. He told me he didn't want his family, you know, to worry and be bothered with what was happening to him.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The major hospital merger between Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and Lahey Health will move forward. State Attorney General Maura Healey signed off on the merger after negotiating a consumer protection agreement with the two networks that includes a cap on annual price increases for 7 years and increased care for low-income patients. WBUR's Martha Biebinger has more on the settlement, which was filed in court today.
This is, in some ways, your basic story of competition. In Massachusetts, we have this one really big hospital network, Partners Healthcare, which owns Mass General and the Brigham. Beth Israel Deaconess and Lahey Health proposed to merge so they could compete for patients, nurses and doctors, and, here's the worry, possibly higher prices. The new entity, Beth Israel Lahey Health, or BILH, said, no, when we get bigger, we'll use our clout to drive down healthcare costs. But the research shows that rarely happens after a hospital merger. So Attorney General Maura Healey pulled out the state's consumer protection law and brought the parties to the table.
This settlement requires BI Lahey to cap its prices and make real investments that will help our residents access high-quality health care.
A statement from Healey lists the details. A 7-year cap on the contract increases BILH can ask for from health insurers. Ads aim to bring in more low-income patients. BILH will have to negotiate business plans with smaller community hospitals. It might hurt as it gets bigger. And it will almost double the hospital's current community contribution. That includes $17 million more to expand substance use and mental health treatment. BILH will hire an independent monitor to make sure these terms are met. And Healey can take the hospitals to court if they violate this consumer protection settlement.
The strong and enforceable conditions in this agreement make this a good deal for Massachusetts.
BILH and its 13 hospitals will be led by Dr. Kevin Tabb, the current CEO at Beth Israel Deaconess. Tabb says BILH shares the AG's commitment to stronger patient care and lower health care costs.
This agreement with the Attorney General does exactly that.
And, says Tabb, clears the way for these hospitals, some of which have been in eastern Massachusetts for more than a century, to continue to drive innovation.
In a way that we have strived to do in the past, but have been limited in terms of our reach and scope, and now we'll be able to offer that to additional patients.
The AG had ammunition going into the settlement talks with Beth Israel Deaconess and Lahey. A report from the state's Health Policy Commission showed the merger could increase health care costs every year in Massachusetts by more than $200 million. Commission Chairman Stuart Altman says he's satisfied with the constraints placed on this merger, including the 7 years of price caps.
In an ideal world, some of us would like them to be permanent, but this is significantly more than any other type of constraint that the state has ever imposed.
Critics of what they call this mega merger are still worried that it will lead to higher prices and pull more affluent patients away from community hospitals and widen the gap between care available to the rich and poor in Massachusetts. But another group that followed these merger talks closely is mostly pleased. Bonnie Gilbert with the Greater Boston Interfaith Organization says the price caps in this settlement should be made permanent and not just for Beth Israel Deaconess and Leahy.
We would like to see this kind of stronger language at least be the beginnings of more constraints on partners and some of the other healthcare providers.
Partners and other hospitals are under a broad state cap on healthcare prices, but unlike in the settlement with the AG, that cap is more of a guideline than a firm limit. Also today, federal regulators cleared the way for the Beth Israel Leahy merger, saying that, quote, while this was not an easy one, the commission has decided not to challenge the proposed transaction.
That's WBUR reporter Martha Biebinger. Stay with us. Coming up, seven women from Dartmouth College allege a culture of sexual misconduct in one of the school's research labs. We'll hear from two of those women and we'll take your calls about some of the challenges facing women in science. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Seven women from Dartmouth College have filed a lawsuit that describes a science department at the school as a 21st century animal house. The women allege that the school was aware of a culture of pervasive sexual misconduct that was created by three now former professors in the Department of Psychological and Brain Sciences. The lawsuit accuses administrators at the Ivy League school of looking the other way. Despite complaints about these professors, the suit seeking $70 million in damages. A spokesman for Dartmouth says the school took unprecedented steps to deal with these professors after an outside investigator found evidence of misconduct. The three professors are no longer at the school. Two resigned. One of them retired. Joining us to talk about this are two of the women who filed the lawsuit. In studio with us, Marissa Evans was an undergraduate at Dartmouth from 2014 to 2018. Hi, Marissa.
Hi.
Also joining us by phone is Anne Marie Brown, who worked as a graduate student in the lab that's named in this lawsuit from 2010 to 2015. She earned her PhD from Dartmouth in January of 2016, and she's currently an adjunct professor there. Thanks for being with us today, Anne Marie.
Absolutely, and thank you, Deborah.
So, Marissa, let's start with you. This suit alleges that these professors, who we should name Todd Heatherton, William Kelly, and Paul Whelan, leered at, groped, sexted, and raped female students. You're the only undergraduate named in this lawsuit. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience?
I took my second neuroscience class in college with Bill Kelly, and after that, he had offered me a job position as a research assistant. So I joined his lab and then worked for about 2 years. And after about a year, things progressed from being just social interactions over text messages and, you know, lab meetings at bars and whatnot to becoming much more sexually driven. And then it started to add on to my career. So if I didn't respond in the way that was most favorable in his eyes, then I would lose hours, I would lose projects, I'd be taken off things. There would be just this very passive-aggressive, controlling, manipulative tone to the lab where it's either you concede to what I want or you have to sacrifice parts of your career.
So you take a class with him. You're, what, 19 years old?
I was 18 at the time.
18 at the time. And he says, I'd like you to work in my research lab.
Yes.
And you're thinking, this is great. Someone is recognizing my talent.
Oh, I was over the moon. I thought that I did perform very well in the class, so I attributed that offer to the fact that I was essentially acing the class. I thought that he had seen something in me academically that made him wish to offer me that position. But over the years, I think that's been one of the most detrimental parts, is that I can't seem to untwine those two. Was it my academics? Was it how well I performed? Or was it the fact that all along maybe he had these intentions?
Anne Marie, you worked with Dr. Whelan. Can you tell us a little bit about your experience?
What happened to me in a nutshell is that, you know, I entered my career in science as a 21-year-old woman my first year of grad school, and I came in with pretty fierce momentum out of undergraduate. You know, I was coming in with publications and awards, and I was entering excited and ready to roll in my academic career. And what I encountered when I got there was not the academic environment that I had been, you know, so excited to join and be a part of. But instead, what I encountered was a toxic work environment of essentially a social and sexual quid pro quo. All students were really expected to participate in this party culture in order to receive the benefits of academic advising. And the culture had clearly more sinister implications for the women involved. Hmm. And if you weren't willing to essentially play ball and, you know, contribute to this party culture as a participant, you were cut off from academic resources to such an extent that your career was effectively concluded by the time you left grad school. And that's exactly what happened to me.
You're saying essentially that that the culture was pervasively bad there, that it was clear that the rules were the people, or particularly the young women who agreed to sort of play by this game, they would be rewarded and others would be shunned. You didn't report this initially, but you did join on later because you felt that you wanted to be in solidarity with the other women who experienced what you experienced and some who experienced things that were even worse. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. And another thing that's important to realize that changed between me not reporting as a graduate student myself and deciding to come back and, you know, contribute to the report is that these men were really, really good at what they did. And what they did was create, first of all, a culture of loyalty in which we all felt compelled to protect them in some way. They also, you know, created a system in which they had full power over our academic careers and made us aware of that fact really frequently. They escalated this grooming behavior, of sexual misconduct very slowly over time and tested us sort of along the way. And the final piece that's most important to sort of realize about the experience is that they made us feel isolated. They progressively cut us off from academic resources, but they also socially cut us off in such a way as to kind of corral us with our experiences and let each of us feel as though our experience with them was an isolated experience. And when we're isolated like that, we attribute, you know, the cause of the issue, you know, to ourselves.
Marissa, what would you say? How do you think the school responded?
So I think one critical issue with how the school responded in the investigation initially was that it was kept very under wraps. So as an undergraduate, we had no information whatsoever. We didn't find out that there was an investigation until undergraduate students posted posters amongst the PBS wall saying, where did these professors go? No one knew. There were rumors spread throughout the campus. I think that was a major failing on Dartmouth's part to not.
PBS is Psychological and Brain Sciences, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But I think that was a major failure on Dartmouth's part to not inform the entire campus, the entire community that this was going on so that they could get a full spectrum picture so that people who had experienced this, not just at a graduate level, but at an undergraduate level as well, could come forward and tell their story. I personally got a call from the investigator and I was told that she just had some clarifying questions and we met and she showed me all of Bill Kelly's responses to my initial report.
And this was the outside investigator that the school brought in to look into your allegations, who was then taking your allegations to the professor and getting the professor's response and coming back to you, asking you what? What were you supposed to do when you saw his response? I guess I don't understand that.
I can't quite understand it either. I think it was just so they could see our allegations, give some sort of response to it. Essentially, in my case, it was just, it didn't seem as if any of it was unwarranted, was his response. Like, I didn't think I was forcing anything upon her. So I guess it differed case by case, but then they were trying to give us an opportunity to come back and say whatever we had about their response, but just the fact that we weren't told ahead of time preemptively that our reports were going to be shown.
And now these three professors that are named in this suit, they've resigned or retired. I'm just wondering, what kind of environment do you think is there right now? Anne-Marie.
the kind of environment that's there right now, it's not necessarily changed. There's, I think, a pervasive feeling and a clearly expressed common feeling that essentially we've plucked out the bad apples and now everything's better. And that's not the experience at the graduate student level still. This was something that was a really common experience that was, it was the scaffolding, the architecture that sort of upheld the pattern of abuse previously. And that scaffolding is still there. And the fact that they're talking about this as we've weeded out the bad apples, we've solved the problem, and leaving that scaffolding alone sets up future abuse to continue unchecked. We would see people getting kicked out of labs regularly, consistently throughout all of graduate school. And so that threat of essentially losing your progress in your career, losing the ability to move forward and effectively ending your career was always present. And these three men used that as a bargaining chip, as a tool to hold power over our heads, but that still exists.
I wonder, Marissa, as a woman in science, what do you hope that listeners take away from this after hearing this conversation?
Well, I would hope from a full spectrum level that young women who are interested in science don't take our struggles as a hindrance to their future careers. I hope that they still go and pursue and, you know, forge new scientific discoveries within the field. I hope people who are already present within academia and higher levels of power hear this and they make a real effort to not gender science, you know, to make sure that there's representation across the board.
And Anne-Marie, I'm wondering, what do you hope comes from this lawsuit?
Dartmouth will address the changes that we need to see. What we are after is an equal playing field, essentially, for women and men in our department and at our school. Women in STEM in general are starting off with a deck stacked against them. There are stereotypes sort of ingrained in our really male-dominated field, even in 2018, moving into 2019, that sort of assert that we don't belong in STEM. So cases like ours are sensational and gain attention because of their severity, but sexual harassment and sexual assault really, you know, are sort of the final straw for women to leave, not sort of the initial push. It's not the first case. Science is now, you know, sort of treated as gendered for many of us, which means we're treated not just as scientists, but as women and scientists, and often as women first in ways that really impact our career negatively.
And do you think that's different from other fields?
I do. I do because of essentially, you know, the stereotypes that are in play. So as a personal example, I took classes in computer science in high school. And at the point where I was taking some more advanced computer science classes, like artificial intelligence, I was one of two women in a class. And even though I wasn't treated poorly in that class, I was treated, you know, like a sore thumb sticking out. I was treated very differently. And that signal, these low-level signals that you don't belong, you're unusual, are there at every step of the way in STEM. And what we experience on a daily basis goes unseen a lot. And so what I really want to do is say to the women, speak up, and to the men, look and listen. It's not just, you know, a problem for women in STEM. It's a pervasive problem of a power imbalance. But there's a lot that happens to women in STEM that goes under the radar, goes unnoticed. And we really have to start shining a light on that. And that's one of the major things that I hope that this lawsuit accomplishes, is shining a light on the systematic abuse that we've experienced.
Well, Anne-Marie, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Marissa Evans, who was an undergraduate at Dartmouth College from 2014 to 2018, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And we want to continue the conversation now about women in science in general. And listeners, we want to hear from you on this, but first we're going to introduce our guests. Joanne Kamins is Executive Director of AdGene. It's a nonprofit hub for research sharing located in Cambridge. She's also one of the founders of the Massachusetts Association of Women in Science. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And on the line with us from Cambridge is Leah Somerville, an associate professor of psychology at Harvard, where she runs her own lab. She also earned her doctorate from Dartmouth. Hi, Leah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And listeners, as we said, we'd like to hear from you as well. Do you feel like you don't belong if you're a woman in science? Are you a woman or a man in the STEM field? And can you tell us what the culture is like where you work? You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Leah, let's start with you. You worked in some of these labs when you were a student at Dartmouth, and many folks might say, you know, I realize it was bad a while ago, you know, but maybe it's gotten better. What's your reaction to these women's stories?
Yeah, thanks for asking. I think I, among many others, have been heartbroken to hear about the recent allegations at Dartmouth. I think also it's caused a lot of faculty members, like myself, to do some soul-searching, to think about how we may have noticed seeds of this kind of culture being sown early on, and also how we as faculty members now, who might serve as role models for female students and trying to have students of our own and figure out the right tones to set of engagement with them and all students, how we might be able to do better beyond even sort of weeding out malicious actors, how we all can, sort of all well-intentioned faculty members among us can do better at setting a positive professional tone that values students, including female students, for their scientific contributions and that other thing.
I do want to say that we did invite Dartmouth to join the conversation today, but the school declined to come on the show, but did issue a statement and said that Dartmouth has taken unprecedented steps here, including revoking the tenure and of the professors involved, terminating their employment. And it's the statement went on to say, quote, "We remain open to a fair resolution of the students' claims through an alternative to the court process, but it says we respectfully disagree with the characterizations of Dartmouth's actions here." So I guess I'm wondering, I mean, Amory Brown told us that yes, these things happened and there were these high-profile professors and it was a big problem and they took this action and they complained and they've come forward with this, but she feels that the structure is still in place for this to continue because that's the culture. What would you say about that, Leah?
Yeah, I think there are many elements to this complex picture. From my vantage point as a former student in these labs at Dartmouth, and now myself now who has my own lab and advises my own students, it's a complicated issue to think about how to make sure to create environments that support students for their scientific contributions. But also to respect the fact that there are inherent power dynamics that sit among us. Many faculty members, I think, even very well-intentioned ones, don't necessarily know the right way to set the tone for those kinds of interactions and engagements with students. Laboratory environments can be very family-like and very close-knit. We spend a lot of time in our labs. We travel with our lab members and so on. And I think it's really up to faculty members to set a tone of appropriateness and to recognize the power that is inherently exists within these relationships. Mm. So that's sort of a broad thought. And to be more specific, I think the kinds of conversations that are needed are ones that are really about the appropriate boundaries that should right. be put in place between students and faculty and in any sort of power dynamics. And to be more explicit in thinking about what kinds of power dynamics exist, whether we want them to be there or not, and how we can behave in ways that respect all parties involved.
Right, because what we did hear from Anne Marie and Marissa was that these were relationships, and then they would suddenly feel as if they weren't sure exactly how to navigate the terrain, mm-hmm. what was personal, what wasn't, and when things got, you know, too sexual in nature, it was difficult, and it sounds like it was very difficult terrain for a young woman to navigate. Joanne, you founded the Mass Association of Women in Science. Tell us your reaction to these stories and about some of your experiences.
Yeah, so unfortunately, now that this is coming to the fore, even more women are coming to talk to me confidentially about their experiences to try and get a handle on what to do. Because unfortunately, when one woman comes forward to report alone, she's disbelieved entirely and has absolutely no power. The system is completely unsympathetic. Unfortunately, in academia, the professors, the lab heads, generally have no boss. there's no real HR. In general, the response is useless. And so one woman coming forward, Leah, I thought your article in Science was excellent in pointing this out. You know, the whole their whole career is basically at risk by not going along with the flow. Mm-hmm. And I don't completely agree that any lab has to worry about the tone. I think we're not just talking about a little bit of, you know, jocular, you know, stuff here. You know, 60% of women have experienced some form of gender harassment, mm-hmm. and 30% sexual coercion or harassment. Mm-hmm. That's a huge number of right. women in academia.
Right. You mentioned that piece by Leah. Leah, that's it was in Science magazine titled "What Can We Learn from Dartmouth?" And you say that this situation, you know, at Dartmouth, maybe it was a little extreme, but this dynamic can play out in innocuous, seemingly innocuous mm-hmm. ways. What did you mean by that? Why don't you elaborate a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can certainly do that. And it really comes down to the idea of power dynamics. Faculty members who advise students have an enormous amount of control over their students' careers. And this is true both in terms of being gatekeepers for resources, as well as writing recommendations or setting individuals up to be competitive for their next career move. And so trainees, I think, experience a lot of implicit pressure to maintain good relationships with their advisor. This can cause trainees to feel sort of a lack of agency or that they are obligated to perhaps engage in activities that they otherwise wouldn't want to. And it might seem like very innocent things, like if a mentor asks their students to come and drink with them at a bar. And the mentor could be very friendly and not necessarily inappropriate in any way. But what can happen, I think, is that if a student didn't want to go to a bar, let's say they didn't feel comfortable at bars, they might not attend, and that might cause them to miss out on scientific opportunities. Hmm. And I think that this is something that was reflected in the stories of the women at Dartmouth, that if they didn't in some ways go along with some of these wishes of the faculty members, that this might cost them educationally.
Right. I guess. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say this happens, I think, very frequently, even among very well-intentioned actors. Mm-hmm. People could be socializing at somewhere that someone else doesn't feel comfortable, and then they might, like, design an experiment and decide to run it and run with that. But the individual who didn't participate might have lost out on that educational opportunity. So I think even in the absence of a very malicious intent, these kinds of dynamics can play out in many, many ways in laboratories.
I guess I wonder, you know, we're talking about labs here, and we're talking about the Dartmouth case specifically, but is something different about STEM fields? I mean, what's happening here? I know, you know, Joanne, you mentioned there's no HR in a lot of these yeah. cases. There may not be a lot of oversight yeah. on the power. I mean, what's unique about this?
I think there's a pervasive culture of disrespecting women. As Leah appropriately puts, this culture of it's okay to make sexual comments or jokes creates a culture of disrespect. And why is it different in science? I don't think it's so different in science. I think it's different in academia. Mm-hmm. I think this power structure of a lab where you have a principal investigator who controls the money and also brings money to the university, that's a huge problem. So if you look at the Jeff Marcy, the physicist who was harassed hundreds of women, right? Mm-hmm. Why was he protected for so long? I would venture to guess that over 1,000 people were complicit in that cover-up. Mm-hmm. They knew for many years. Everybody knew. Why did they cover it up? Because he brought so much money to the university. Mm-hmm. And so I think that administrators really have to step up, and I think that the funders need to absolutely, no strikes. If you are convicted of harassment, and I don't mean accused, I mean convicted and shown in an investigation, you should not be allowed to have any kind of funding for your research.
Okay. I want to remind our listeners that you can join in this conversation. Are you working in the STEM field? Are you a woman or a man? And what is the culture like there? Do you think that there's something about a power imbalance in STEM fields for women? Call us with your thoughts, your opinions at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Julie is calling from Lincoln. Julie, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a scientist, and I was a postdoctoral fellow. I want to thank these young women for coming forward, but I want to point out that it's not just in the academic environment, but I work for the federal government and experienced something similar in the description of the environment of social and sexual quid pro quo describes it perfectly. And when I reported it, I experienced 5 years of lengthy EEO process of deposition. And it was ultimately, you know, resolved when it went outside of the Veterans Health Administration. But one of the dangers is once it's brought up, then male colleagues simply don't invite the female colleagues out at conferences when there's a social gathering. Mm-hmm. And so then they're excluded in that way.
So there are still ramifications, maybe not as overt, but you felt ramifications from speaking up. Julie.
Sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, so, you know, when you speak up, you know, you go through a period of, you know, isolation and, you know, you're subject to deposition. But then once it comes out, and even if it falls in your favor, you have other male colleagues who then, you know, their response is to just exclude their female colleagues from the social events that happen at scientific conferences.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Julie, thanks so much for the call. I guess, Joanne, what I'd like to ask here is something she said. She said eventually it was resolved. It took a long time. There were still reverberations. But when we talk about resolving these type of things and coming forward, when we were speaking with Marissa and Anne-Marie Brown, the two women from Dartmouth earlier in the program, Marissa told us that the school hired an independent investigator after they filed a complaint. And this independent investigator took her allegations and then went to the accused professor and then brought, unbeknownst to her, she never knew that her allegations were going to be outlined specifically to this professor, and then came back and said, well, this is what the professor said about what you said. Is that typically how these investigations
are done? Yeah, it's really unfortunate. It's not just in academia. That's going on in companies as well. So I'm involved in talking with a lot of women in biotech and pharma as well. Mm-hmm. So one anecdote is, you know, a woman went to HR because she had actual evidence, she had texts of someone in her company inappropriately addressing her through text. She went to HR, and HR told her to go work it out with the other guy. It's just a misunderstanding. So, you know, hashtag believe women. This is not, essentially, we're just told it's just a misunderstanding, you know, go work it out with the perpetrator. And of course, that's the one thing you can't do. You're so embarrassed. You're so devalued. You have so much imposter syndrome, you know, that you think, oh, this person likes me not because of my science. They like me because they like how I look. And that's really not what science is looking for, is, you know. So this is pervasive, and it's the and I would say I would, you know, shed some light on the women who are trying to change that and get people to listen. And they're trolled on social media. They're harassed. I don't know if you know the three women that are just winning the Disobedience Award from the MIT Media Lab, Beth McLaughlin, Sherry Martz, and Tarana Burke, who coined the phrase Me Too, Beck McLaughlin, the founder of the Me Too STEM movement. I mean, these women are...
Actually, the Dartmouth women are invited to the ceremony.
Yeah, that's right. They're invited to the ceremony. Yeah. They're just being tortured for speaking up. And wow, kudos to them for speaking up. Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Right, right. I want to go now to a caller from Brookline who doesn't want her name used. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, I just wanted to share. I'm a historian of science and technology, and these aren't issues that are just within science itself. We women in the history of science and technology face very, very similar uphill battles. And I'll share with you that I've been harassed by other women in the field who are more science-based, whereas I'm a historian of science and technology. And I'm going to just sort of reiterate, it's the institution of when you try to go and butt up against the issues of harassment, the institutions themselves, it's in their self-interest, even if, and I had a case in which the Faculty Senate agreed with me that I was being harassed and being discriminated against by another woman, that it went nowhere, and I still lost my job. Which is why I don't want to use my name, because I don't want that to actually, you know, more impede my career as it is.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks so much for the call. I wonder, Leah, can you talk a little bit about that, about how much of this is a power dynamic? I know you mentioned it initially, but are you hearing similar stories to what we just heard from our caller from Brookline, that you know, it's difficult for people to come forward? There are a lot of ramifications, and it's not just men harassing women. It's harassment and bullying in general.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that there's a common thread of conversation around
people thinking about coming forward with some sort of report about misconduct or mistreatment, but being really scared to do that. And I think there are several reasons why somebody could be scared. It exposes them as a vulnerable party. It leaves them open for potential retaliation. It could erode certain ongoing relationships that might feel important for them and their career path. And it might also, I think there's a general question mark in academic context of whether the sort of broader administrative bodies that work on these cases necessarily have the best interest of the person coming forward in mind. These individuals work for the university, and of course, there are certain elements, whether deserved or not, I'm not sure, but elements of mistrust, I think, for coming forward with these very sensitive allegations. Mm. I think people also tend to try and recast these experiences in a way that tries to determine whether they themselves played a role or were somehow could find a way to blame themselves for these experiences, which, of course, they shouldn't be blamed for in any way. But people tend to go into that mind space, which might also cause somebody not to come forward because they might themselves feel shameful or fearful in because of their whatever the context is that they found themselves in. Mm-hmm. And so those, I think, all would provoke a person to maybe be motivated to brush things off, to stay silent, to not come forward and speak up, because of all the uncertainties and fears that go along with being a loud voice.
Okay. I want to take another call here. A man joining in the conversation here. Eugene is calling from Cambridge. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to thank you ladies for being brave and standing up and sharing their stories. I was a grad student at University of Michigan, and I think one of the issues that's common is the abuse of power. And I really did not find my former advisor. He's a human. He makes mistakes, but the institution, when you bring these issues up to them, what they do to try to protect themselves instead of actually trying to resolve the matter, I think makes the problem much worse. And mine was related to intellectual property abuse.
Intellectual property, can you say that again? I think we
yeah,
lost you a little bit.
Intellectual property. So the idea of whose invention was it? And what are the consequences if you don't name that advisor as an inventor? And conflicts of interest that arise from that. And I think when you try to reach it to every level within an institution, they will continue to try to protect themselves and instead of actually trying to resolve the matter.
All right. Well, Eugene, thanks for the call. I'm wondering, Joanne, do you think that that Eugene has a point here, that there are these structures that need to, keep going to perpetuate their existence? And sometimes that's why this power hierarchy comes into play. It affects men and women.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think Leah mentioned it also. I mean, the bullying is not just towards women. Unfortunately, women bear the brunt of it because the sexual aspect, not that men are not sexually harassed, but the numbers are far smaller, as we know now from studies, from anonymous studies. But the problem is the accountability. There's just no accountability. And every single student I know knows of an advisor that has done something really seriously unethical and potentially illegal. So, for example, taking the work of their students and claiming it as their own, it's plagiarism,
right.
it's theft of intellectual property. These are legal issues, not just moral issues, aside from the moral issues. And also there's this whisper network, and in general, the students know. But as soon as someone comes forward, they're punished for it. Mm. And so the power is so inequitable that they have no ability to come forward. So I posit that the peers, a lot of the professors who pretend and tell me there's nothing going on in my department, you can't just be a good person anymore by not doing it yourself. It is your responsibility to say, that's not how we do it here.
I wonder, how do you think, and I'd like both of you to answer this question, but you first, Joanne, how do you think this affects science?
Yeah, I think this is a huge loss of resources. I mean, the effort that it takes to combat harassment and bullying is wasted effort that could be leading to brilliant discoveries. This is a dialing down of our efficiency in a huge way. It's a misuse. You don't have to be a jerk to make good science happen. In fact, the best labs have the best mentors. And so the culture, it needs to change what's accepted as positive, is you need to have both a good culture where you're training scientists and producing good scientists, not just one of those.
And Leah, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would completely agree with what was just said and add that when these kinds of mistreatment situations go on, whether they're sexual in nature or power grabs or what have you, I think that one of the impacts it has on trainees is that it diminishes their sense of value as a scientist. That is, that their contributions might not be respected and utilized the same way. And I think what it does is it erodes a person's level of self-confidence about themselves as a scientist. And so I know in the wake of these kinds of situations, many people will quietly leave the field and find another career path. But that's a huge loss for science in general. Because the system didn't treat them well, and it's our loss that they decided to leave.
I have to say, I found it very surprising that this was so current. We're talking about these kinds of things happening right now, 2017, 2018, 2016, and I think I may have thought that stuff like this happened a long time ago, maybe, but it's happening right now. So I want to know what advice you give to young women, and what do you think needs to change? I know you talked about accountability, but is there some sort of deeper kind of cultural issue that needs to be addressed here? Why is this still happening? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I have one. We need to do two things. We need to change the system and hold people legally accountable for good behavior and good performance. But we also need to help the students make better choices. So I'm constantly out there urging science trainees to go to labs that are known for good mentoring and good culture. And don't give your hard work to the labs that are not known for that. And what happens is they get the warnings and they ignore them often. And they assume, this won't happen to me. I do. I am strong. I can do this, you know. And unfortunately, they're not making good choices. So for trainees now, I would say don't work for those people. But we still need to change the system. It can't be on the trainees indefinitely.
Don't work for Dartmouth. Very prestigious, right? Very prestigious, you know, place that you want on your resume. You want to have that research. And I mean,
how can I convince you that if this happens to you, you will not be, you know, you will not have a good career in science? So maybe that's the choice. Go to the institutions that are showing responsibility. There's plenty of good ones. You do not need to go to Dartmouth to train to be a scientist.
Leah, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think in addition to rooting out bad actors and empowering students to have the appropriate channels to speak up, I think that there are also day-to-day activities that many well-intentioned mentors and faculty members can do to improve the culture, even in their local environment. So I think this is sort of everybody's responsibility, not just sussing out particular bad actors. But I think that we need to have more transparent conversations about power dynamics and boundaries that are appropriate, and solicit students' input about what kind of lab environment makes them feel worthy, most worthy as a scientist, and really allow those conversations to be open so that scientists can make more conscious choices about how to behave and treat other people, which I think will just take what might be the non-problematic side of this cultural context and just make it better and bring in reinforcements for that.
Okay, Leah Somerville, an associate professor of psychology at Harvard, where she runs her own lab. She also earned her doctorate from Dartmouth. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Joanne Kamens, executive director of AdGene, a science nonprofit in Cambridge and one of the founders of the Massachusetts Association of Women in Science. Thanks for coming in. Stay with us. Coming up, the man who says Whitey Bulger regularly wrote to him. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. As the investigation continues into the murder of Boston mobster James Whitey Bulger in a West Virginia prison last month, an 86-year-old Florida man has come forward with letters he says he regularly received from Bulger. Charlie Hopkins says he knew Bulger because they both knew the same people from their time in prison in Alcatraz during the 1950s. Hopkins has been corresponding with Bulger for decades, and in particular, he points to one letter that Bulger wrote to him in July of 2017. In that letter, Hopkins says the 89-year-old Bulger described his health as deteriorating and said Bulger wrote that he wished for a peaceful death. Now, this letter calls into question, again, why authorities have determined that Bulger's health had improved so they could move him to the West Virginia prison, which provides more limited medical services than the facility where Bulger was incarcerated. And, of course, Bulger was found beaten to death just hours after he was moved to West Virginia. When we called Charlie Hopkins earlier today, we started by asking him what Bulger said in that letter.
The one I got in July, he talked about how his health was going down, that they wanted to put him in a hospital downtown, and he refused. And he told me that the reason he didn't want to go back is when they had him in there before, they kept him chained to the bed, and they had a guard watching him 24 hours a day.
So what he basically said to you in the letter that he wrote in July of 2017 was that his health was deteriorating. They wanted to take him into a hospital, but he didn't want to go because
he said he was having heart problems, heart pain, and he couldn't breathe. Said they was having to give him oxygen, and he told me several times over like the past year or so that he needed oxygen, but they wouldn't let him have it in his cell.
How often did you hear from him?
Once a month, sometimes twice. He told me things he didn't tell his family. He told me he didn't want his family, you know, to worry and, you know, be bothered with what was happening to him.
So prison officials say that Whitey Bulger was moved from a prison in Florida to West Virginia because his health had improved. So that's obviously very different from what you heard from him.
Oh, it's in his own words. How can they say that when he's telling me in the July letter how he was having chest pains, that he was he told me a couple of times in different letters that he was having blackouts, and he would take a nitro pill and said that would bring him out of it.
So why do you think if he had these health problems that he was transferred to West Virginia, which had fewer medical services than the prison where he had been?
Well, to start with, they hated him, mm-hmm. and I've been there. I know how they lie. I spent 11 years in federal prison.
Right, you did 11 years for kidnapping.
Kidnapping, yes.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But you never met Whitey Bulger.
No, he came to the Rock right after I left. I was just leaving when, you know, he came in.
So it's my understanding that you and Whitey started writing to each other after you wrote first, because you learned that Whitey Bulger had paid $10,000 to have another Alcatraz prisoner's remains have a proper burial in Oklahoma, opposed to being...
Yeah, that was our friend, Joe Kern. He spent $23,000.
$23,000.
His bodyguard said it was $23,000. He also took a satchel full of $100 bills to the funeral, and he handed them out by the handfuls to the poor Indians.
Whitey did this?
Yes.
Now, you know, some people listening to you talk, they might think, you know what? Whitey Bulger was a violent man. He killed people. He ratted on people. They don't have a lot of...
No, he didn't rat. He wasn't no informer. The FBI used that as a cover. They had to have some excuse for why they were protecting him.
What do you think releasing these letters and talking about them publicly now? I mean, why do that? What does it do?
The only thing I put in the letters that I showed Shelley at the Boston Globe proves that his health was getting worse, not better. That's the whole idea. They're definitely lying about his health. They use that as an excuse for doing what they did. That his health got better and he didn't need to be there. Hell, he can't hardly breathe. Said he was needing oxygen to breathe. Mm. And that he was having all kind of chest pains with his heart. Mm-hmm. And he was in a wheelchair. He had guys in there that would wheel him around. Mm. He told me he got caught on the yard one day in bad weather. Said lightning started popping. And said that... if it hadn't been for the guys that would wheel him around, that he would have probably got hit by lightning. He said, and I can just see the headline saying, Whitey died in chair. He made a joke out of it.
Well, Mr. Hopkins, I appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. Charlie Hopkins corresponded with Whitey Bulger for several years before Bulger was murdered in prison last month. Mr. Hopkins, thanks so much.
All right. You're welcome.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Zoe Mitchell, with help from Eve Zukoff and Walt Wolfman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hati. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.